Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today our guest is Great Salt Lake Commissioner and Great Salt Lake Strike Team Co-Chair Brian Steed. Strike Team has released its Great Salt Lake Data and Insights Summary prepared for the 2026 Utah Legislature. And Brian Steed, who also serves as Executive Director of the USU Janet Quinney Lawson Institute of Land, Water, and Air, says it will take all of us working together to protect and sustain the lake. We're going to talk today about the current state of the Great Salt Lake and look at next steps to try to restore the lake to health. Brian Steed, thanks for coming back in.
Thank you so much for having me.
Appreciate it a lot. This is wonderful. Busy, I guess, every time busy time of year for you, but during the legislature, pretty busy.
Especially busy. Spend a lot of time at the legislature this time of year and help them understand the nature of the problem as well as some of the things that we're doing to help solve it.
Yeah. So you have released the insight summary, gave a presentation recently. I want to start with some scenarios that you put out, the strike team put out. One is baseline, right? One is kind of a middling scenario, and one is, I guess, what we'd like to see. What we'd like to see, the ideal, which would put the lake into healthy territory, right? Mm-hmm. Over several years, that's 800,000 acre feet per year, which seems like a lot.
Yeah.
Maybe put that into context for us.
Agreed. That's it is a lot. You know, Tom, before I get into that, let me just say this. What the strike team is, the strike team was a collaboration between USU researchers, so it's the Janet Quinney Lawson Institute for Land, Water, and Air, as well as water lab folks and some folks in different departments around the campus, as well as researchers at the University of Utah that have been working on this as well. And then we brought in kind of those technical experts from the state to do this. And so what we've been trying to do through the strike team is provide the best data that's available out there so that we're able to operate on a common understanding. When we've done that work, it's shown that, you know, the good news is more water actually means you can have more lake recovery and you can have higher lake levels. And so on Great Salt Lake, we do track levels as a proxy for health. And the state's identified, you know, the level of 4,198 feet above sea level as being the healthiest level. And that's where we'd like to see the lake be. We're currently, as of this morning, sitting at 4,191.8 on the south arm, and that's well below it. And so we know that there's a distance to make up. And so in looking at that, we have to figure out how we're going to make up that difference. And so, but in order to do that, we got to find out how much water it is. We have been working with those experts to run scenarios to say, okay, so how much do we need extra? And 800,000 acre feet has been identified as the fastest way to get back to recovery. I will say that that's a lot of water. That's, you know, if put it into context, that's 800,000 American football fields a foot deep in water. It's a lot of water. And when you look at what that means for how we use water in the area, I think it's pretty aggressive. That being said, there's good news here too. More water means more recovery. And when we see the lake coming back up to say 4,192 or then 4,195, all of those have substantial impact for it. And so it impacts things like that exposed lake bed. It impacts things like the ecology of the lake. And so all of those things we will continue to track. But yeah, 800,000 feet is a lot of water.
Mm. Now, there's a middle path there, 250,000 mm-hmm. acre feet per year. Still quite a bit, but and maybe more doable.
And I think that, you know, when you look at what the state's done, we're actually we're approaching that. So just this past week, the state announced the acquisition of U.S. Magnesium with that. It was part of their bankruptcy procedures. And when you think about what U.S. Mag is, it's been a big mineral producer on the west side of the Great Salt Lake. They have a tremendous amount of water rights, and so they're pumping directly out of Great Salt Lake. The state's acquisition means that we can keep as much as 144,000 acre feet in the lake, not pump that out of the lake, and that's a big deal. And then in addition to that, when you look at what the state's engaged in with intentional leases through both the efforts of the Great Salt Lake Watershed Enhancement Trust as well as through the Great Salt Lake Commissioner's Office, we're over, you know, 160,000 acre feet of leased water. So we're approaching those levels. And what 250,000 acre feet does, honestly, this makes it so we stabilize, and that's something when you look at these terminal saline lake ecosystems. So what I mean by terminal is water goes in, then it evaporates off. These systems are all over the world, and they're in peril all over the world. So we would be doing something that really doesn't happen very often in stopping the decline. And I think that's something to be celebrated. But honestly, then we got to start the hard work then to start recovering the lake. So 250 is, I think, doable. I think that we're actually close to getting an additional 250,000 acre feet. And I think that's good news.
So with that 250,000 acre feet a year, would that get the lake to healthy level?
So it doesn't get it to healthy level in any time soon. And right. so, but it does stabilize the lake and bring it back up from current conditions.
Right.
And I think that that's juxtaposed against what would be the normal condition right now, which was if we continue on the trend, we would expect to see the lake continue to decline into unhealthier positions.
Yeah. I want to just follow up briefly on U.S. Magnesium acquisition. There's been some question that it's assumed the state purchasing U.S. Magnesium is about the water. Is the lake going to get the water because of this?
I think that's the intent.
Yeah.
And that's certainly how we have worked. I mean, I will say this. There may be other producers out there of minerals that can do so with by far less water footprint. We have seen that in other technology. I mean, there's a lithium company operating on the lake now that can do that with by far less water than these traditional evaporative ponds. And so I don't, if people see a satellite image of the lake, you can see that on the peripheries of the lake, on both sides, there's been these big evaporative ponds. And the mineral companies have been able to pump water out of the lake, put it in these evaporative ponds and get it more concentrated. There's new technologies that doesn't require those big evaporative ponds, and we look forward to engaging with newer technologies if they're available. But in the meantime, to get that water in the lake, keep it in the lake, is a big deal.
Now, over time, the climate doesn't seem to be cooperating, right? We had those two very nice snow years. Now it seems like we're back to, what, the third lowest level? We're right back to a problem, right?
So in terms of where we are for the snow year this year, we probably are in the worst year we've ever seen since it's been recorded. That's something that gives me a tremendous amount of anxiety. I'm weird that way. I've had people in my neighborhood say, wow, isn't this amazing? You know, a warmer winter. And I'm like, no, it's horrible. So it causes neighborhood arguments. But in the whole, we would like to see wetter conditions. Obviously, we did have those two really good snow years that provided us some more time to get some more tools in place. And I think those tools are now in place. But now we really are pushing up against lower lake levels again. And then following that lower lake levels with really what might be a historically low snowpack year, that means very little runoff. And so we're tracking that. Now, there's good news here. I think the good news is, one, that it has not been a low precipitation year. It's been a low snowpack year. And that precipitation means that we have higher soil moisture conditions. And especially if you look around areas around Great Salt Lake, the wetlands are wet. And I think that's positive. The second thing I would just say is, based on some management we've done on the south arm of the Great Salt Lake, the salinity levels, which we would expect to spike with low lake levels, are actually in really healthy conditions. And that's something I think that gives us a little more time as well. But again, it just makes us worried when you're trending into those bad years.
Yeah, it certainly is. For example, just on a personal note, I've been out playing tennis all through this winter outside.
It should not be.
I'm enjoying it, but there's a problem here, right?
Exactly. And yeah, I understand that real nice ability to recreate outdoors. I'm a Logan native, so I understand how that goes. But there's a trade-off there, and the trade-off is that we would like to see colder, we'd like it to see wetter, and that's what's going to provide us that water through the summer that we need.
Yeah. I wanted to quote Governor Cox upon signing the Great Salt Lake 2034 charter. I'll have you talk to me about that. He says, across the world, saline lakes are in decline. Utah will be the exception. So that there's at least a determination on paper and in the hearts of our leaders, right, to save the lake, get the lake into healthy level. But kind of bucking against the trend, right? Saline lakes across the world in decline.
So when you look at the trend everywhere, and we could go through the RLC, or we could go through Lake Urmia in Iran, or we could go through even closer to home, Owens Lake in California, the trend has been, you know, if water makes it to these salty bodies of water, that's water wasted. And that's how people have seen it for a long time. We're now seeing that has huge consequences environmentally if we let these lakes dry up. And so I take it to heart that the governor very much wants to engage positively on the lake. The Great Salt Lake Charter is a pretty good indication of that. So this is something spearheaded by his office to say that the state is going to take very seriously our commitment to Great Salt Lake. I was there at the charter signing. He was there with the president of the Utah State Senate, as well as the Speaker of the House, all of which signed to say we're committed to saving Great Salt Lake. And listen, Tom, I think that's great news that Utah has the determination to be the exception to this trend rather than part of the course of history.
Another thing, I'm not sure with who this was, but maybe the governor, maybe from your report, we've gone now from crisis management on the lake to long-term stewardship. So maybe talk a little bit about what has promoted this transition, what the good news, I guess.
So I think in 2022, all of us had a bit of a wake-up call to where we saw the lowest lake levels that we'd seen in recorded history. And concurrent with that, we had all the things that we would expect to see on the negative side. We saw high salinity levels, and those high salinity levels then created a condition to where the organisms that live in the south arm of the Great Salt Lake, brine shrimp and brine flies, really were having a difficult time reproducing. So we saw low levels of them. And that means that all of those migratory birds, 10 to 12 million migratory birds that pass through, were having a problem with that. And so they didn't have the groceries, so to speak, as they migrate through to fuel up and to continue the migrations. And so this got us all really worried. So 2022, you saw a bunch of a flurry of legislative action. You saw the creation of the Great Salt Lake Commissioner's Office, and you saw a bunch of other meaningful legislative changes. And that's allowed for some management. One of the things we have done is, and not to get into the technicalities of it, but the South Arm and the North Arm are divided by the Union Pacific Causeway. The North Arm is too salty to sustain those brine shrimp and brine flies. And what we've been doing is keeping more fresh water on the South Arm, mixing that fresh water, and that's been able to keep those salinity levels lower and healthier. And I think that's something to be celebrated, so that we actually are in a better spot now than we had been prior. Now starts the hard part, though, too, is getting then not only to manage the salinity, but also managing salinity while bringing up those lake levels. And so on this year, that's going to be a real challenge, but I'm so happy to have the commitment from our legislative and our gubernatorial leaders to make sure that we are able to get there.
No, in the in your insights summary, you have several areas where you feel you've made progress in 2025. Let's take a break and then want to come back and talk about that. And then later in the program, obviously, we'll talk about what needs to be done, what you hope comes out of the legislature, et cetera.
Absolutely.
We'll have more with Brian Steed, who is Great Salt Lake Commissioner, following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Great Salt Lake Commissioner and Great Salt Lake Strike Team Co-Chair, also Executive Director of the USU Janet Quinney Lawson Institute of Land, Water, and Air, Brian Steed, is who we're talking to today. We're talking about the Great Salt Lake. The Strike Team just released their annual insights report for the legislature. So I want to talk first of all in this segment, Brian Steed, about 2034 and these projected levels. You have a line here, right? 2034 and where we hope to be by that time, beyond, of course, as well. That's not random, right? I think the Olympics, the current Olympics start this week, right?
Correct.
In Milan, Cortina, and Salt Lake City has the Winter Olympics 2034. That's hopefully a riveting, focusing event. We don't want to have huge dust storms and a disappearing lake at that point.
That's absolutely right. And when you look at previous Olympic stories and how those stories have been told, you know, we had the Beijing Olympics and it was known for air quality problems, or the Paris Olympics, we saw problems with water quality on the Seine. We know that the Great Salt Lake is a vulnerability if we don't have a healthier lake by the time the world shows up here. And I don't want to be the guy out standing, you know, on the shore of the Great Salt Lake explaining to the BBC what's gone wrong, mm-hmm. right? And so looking at all that, I think that we have a real opportunity to showcase the Utah way and being able to solve difficult problems. The Great Salt Lake is indeed a difficult problem, but I think that it's something that we have intent as well as momentum to make sure that we get it right and get it in a much better position for 2034.
So intent and momentum, what's your best projection? Are we going to be okay in 2034?
So certainly we have the commitment of my bosses to do that. And so we're gonna try our very best to get the amount of water to the lake that it needs to have to get it to healthier levels. There's some good news here. If we get it up to, 4195, we're doing something that really hasn't been seen anywhere else in the world. And so when you have these lakes start to decline, we see that decline continue. We very much hope to correct that trend here and absolutely are confident that we can. And I think that you've seen real buy-in, right? I mean, just if you look at the amount of money, last week the legislature, authorized $30 million to acquire a tremendous amount of water rights on the lake. There has been other efforts that have allowed us to get into leasing and other things for those with water rights, as well as big conservation efforts that I think that really do show that Utah has the will to do this.
We'll get into all of those areas. I wanted to focus on the water rights. Mm-hmm. There's been some programs or proposed programs to allow farmers especially to temporarily sell those water rights. So this could be a commodity, right? If you don't plant as much, then sell your water rights for that year only and get some money in. Are we going to see that expanded? And how's that going?
So absolutely. So there's, if you look at the history of Utah, we were settled by people that had to grow food. And so like much of the West, we have a first in time, first in right system of water rights appropriation. So we have a system where as long as you're using that water and putting it to beneficial use and you're the first, you have the oldest and most senior water right, right? Other water rights become junior to that. And so when we look at who has the majority of water rights in the Great Salt Lake system, it's still agriculture because they were here first and they have been continually putting this to beneficial use. So one of the things we've been trying to do very much is to engage with that community and to make sure that we have the tools in place that we can make it win-win. And water is valuable. Water can be seen as something that's a commodity that they absolutely can sell. And so that's something that we have been engaging in a leasing program with them. We've seen some successes on that. And if you look at, the strike team report, when you look at both acquisitions and leases, they're delivering an additional 163,000 acre feet of water per year. And that's something that's a big deal, right? And that's mostly from traditional agricultural users. The Great Salt Lake Watershed Enhancement Trust, for instance, just released a deal where they're engaged with the old Huntsman Abbey. If you remember that there was an abbey in Huntsville, Utah, they're no longer producing as much food off those crops. And so they agreed to lease the water to the state. And I think that's a really big deal and shows how agriculture can also receive a profit from this. Now, there's some cultural beliefs, right? And some cultural senses that, hey, people don't want to lose the sense of who they are or the ability to be what they want to be. And farming is one of those identities. It's not just a job. And so making sure that people understand that this is not permanent and it's not something that we're taking away future opportunities, I think, is really key as well.
Mm. Now, you can accumulate more water, right? But I think what we've found and hopefully learned some lessons in is shepherding that water all the way to the lake. Tell me about that.
So it's a challenge because, if you deal with that first in time, first in right system, let's say you keep water in the lake, you keep water in a stream, that stream flows down and now you have another senior water right user that might be able to access that. So we've been working very closely with the state engineer. That's the state entity that's required to monitor those water rights. We do have statutory remedies in place to say, if we do put that into a leased water, that it will get delivered to the lake. Even this year in the legislative session, some of those efforts are even being further codified. And so I don't think it's the problem that it was before. It's certainly still a challenge. And I think that if we were to lay out what the challenge was, one, we didn't have sufficient monitoring in place, and two, there wasn't the legal structure. Legal structure has been changed, and we actually spent a lot of money in getting the monitoring in place as well. And so I think we're in a much better place than we had been.
Hmm. Talking about more water, I'm reading from the executive summary of the report. There's some water out in the Newfoundland evaporation basin.
Yep.
How are we going to get that water in?
So if you go out west of the lake, there's this very large, it looks like a salt flat if you look at the satellite imagery. Two things have happened in the Newfoundland basin. One, when the Union Pacific Causeway built that railway across, we actually trapped some water in the Newfoundland Basin that otherwise would have migrated into the Great Salt Lake. And then we actually, in the 1980s, engineered that even further to make sure that water flows away from the lake rather than back into the lake. We very much think that there's an opportunity to re-engineer that and to fix it so the natural flows would go back into Great Salt Lake. And it's not a trivial amount of water. I mean, even in low water years, we're seeing as much as 30,000 acre feet trapped and evaporated in that basin rather than flowing back into Great Salt Lake, as would have been the normal course for that water. And then in some years, it's as high as 100,000 acre feet of water. That's, again, a lot of water that we were able to get there. So I think that we did some engineering analysis on this through the Utah State Water Laboratory and starting to look to say, what would it take to do that? Those are in the very preliminary stages, but I think there is some opportunity to kind of make those flows natural again, rather than to have it flow away from the lake as was not the natural course.
Hmm. One more thing is, I haven't really focused on this. Your report does, Phragmites. Tell me about this.
So we have one of the banes of my existence is Phragmites. It's a large reed. It grows in wetlands, and you'll see it everywhere. And it's a non-native invasive. I mean, it was native to Eurasia, and it is extraordinarily water-hungry. I mean, an acre of Phragmites is going to consume about 4 acre feet of water per year. If 1 acre, 4 feet of water, and that's a lot. It's more so than other native vegetation, and so we are very aggressively attacking Phragmites this year. One, we have been for a few years, but when you think about this, Phragmites does two things. One, it just naturally consumes a lot of water, and two, it grows very thick through wetlands, and so it often traps water on the upside of that rather than allow that water to flow through. So in October, we had big rainstorms. Those big rainstorms normally would have dumped a lot of water into the lake. Instead, we saw some flooding areas around northern and actually southern Davis County because Phragmites stance had blocked off that normal flow. We have to go in and be very aggressive in removing that, getting back to the native vegetation as well as the natural flows. And I think that we are making progress on that, but we still have some ways to go. And it grows so very well because it has a very extensive root system. So it takes some time, but we're making progress, and I think that could also represent a large amount of water savings. The other thing, as I just say this, one of the things we have been doing over the last few years is fixing the holes in the bucket, right? Putting water in, if there's holes in the bucket, well, then water spills out. And think about this. We had, you know, one of the holes was Phragmites. We're plugging up that hole by removing the Phragmites. Another hole was, you know, to say, you put water in the lake, mineral companies can pump it out, right? Are you really making any progress? And so we've worked with those mineral companies to get better technologies, as we talked about in the previous segment.
Mm. One of the bits of progress in the last year or so, you have improved understanding about who's using the water, right? Mm-hmm. We were underestimating residential use.
That's right.
You and I. So tell me about that.
And I think this is actually a really key finding of the report. I probably should have led with it, in fact, because I think that what we had been doing for a long time is accounting for water you put on your lawn and garden is kind of percolating into the ground. There's new studies that show that if you put water on your lawn, about 94% of that is going to be consumed, right? And so when you look at the water usage patterns, when you account for that accurately on how much water we're putting outside of our homes, that trend actually goes up pretty substantially on how much water we're using over time. There's some good news here. Per capita water use is down, but as we've continued to grow and as we've continued to grow in a way that facilitates large landscaped areas around the houses, we still have a large water consumption as part of that. We can do better. And there's different seed blend varieties here that are available at Utah State University, but there's other things that we can do. And I talked recently with Dr. Kelly Cope, who's, you know, one of the renowned experts on landscaping. She runs the Center for Water Efficient Landscaping here at Utah State. And she's really optimistic that if we just had people water their lawns what it takes versus what people think it takes, there's a substantial water savings, as much as 30%. And if you're interested, Utah State does, in fact, do these surveys. You can contact that center and do that. But I think that's really good news. Consider this, Tom. If we just watered our lawn, what it requires versus what we think, it's over 100,000 extra acre feet of water that can potentially flow into the lake. That's that's a whole bunch of water for very little cost. And actually, you save money by just watering your lawns less.
Agriculture still is a big part of this, right?
Absolutely.
We've now increased that percentage with you and me, right? That urban use, residential use, but agriculture is still a big part. I know a lot in the agricultural sector feel picked on, feel like we're unduly concentrating all of our attention on them, but still a part to play from agriculture. What is that role?
So it's been really interesting because I do think that people have felt picked on from agriculture, and sometimes when you look at some people say, you know what the problem is? Agriculture, we're just going to go out and take water from ag. If that were me and I'm sitting as my livelihood and my chosen occupation, that would absolutely freak me out. And so I think that how we approach ag has to be very much in the spirit of working for win-win solutions. I think there's good news that there are win-win solutions, and water leasing is one of those win-wins. I'm happy to say that we've worked very closely with the Farm Bureau and with the Utah Department of Agriculture and Food. We're coming out. There's a bill in the legislative session, HB 410, which is the Ag Water Leasing Program, and this is one that absolutely ag has been supportive of, and say that we can make this work. And so, working for those win-win solutions, I think, is really key.
I think there's been some encouragement on drip irrigation in agriculture. Is that being adopted?
So, drip irrigation is being evaluated currently. There are some areas in the Bear River Basin that has done that. I mean, I can tell you that as part of a state trip, we spent some time in Israel. As you look at what Israel has done oftentimes to make itself more water secure, drip irrigation and agriculture has been one of their key success stories. It's expensive. And so, you know, transitioning from a sprinkler system to a drip system is very pricey for the average farmer. And so that's going to take some time to get more implementation. And it's not awesome for certain types of crops. It's better for others. And so we're working with the experts here at Utah State University and throughout the Intermountain West to make sure that there are abilities to do that. Interestingly, I have visited a farm in Arizona that grows alfalfa on a fully drip system. They've actually increased water efficiency tremendously through doing that. But again, it's quite expensive.
Mm. So can they do overall savings, even though it's expensive? Savings from the...
Absolutely.
What they save?
So in that case, they were saving a tremendous amount of money on the pumping costs because it was an operation that was based on groundwater pumping. And so, yeah, they actually – this penciled for them, right? But on surface water, it was a little harder to make pencil.
Hmm. By the way, the trip to Israel was, I guess, a couple of years ago or something, mm-hmm. right? Anything else you remember from that stood out to you from what they're doing that we could learn from?
So I think that when you look at the cultural transformation in Israel, what they've done from water, they've gone from one of the most water insecure places on the planet to a place of water surplus. They absolutely have done very aggressive conservation. Every place you go to wash your hands in Israel has a reminder, right, that water is precious. Kids are taught this in school. Right. And I think there's been a more intentional approach to how you deal with water. That's led to some real dividends and some real investments. The other thing they've done, they live next to the Mediterranean, and so they've done a bunch of money into desalination as well as to water recycling there. And so I think there are statewide, we could certainly start to look at some of those things. Obviously, desalination, harder to do here because we don't live next to an ocean, but one of the things the state is certainly considering is engaging with you know, partners in California or other places to where they can meet part of their water needs there. And that may be in addition to the Great Salt Lake, but it's certainly something that I think all of us in the West have to be much more mindful of.
Mm. And not just Great Salt Lake, right?
Correct.
There's an ongoing debate over Colorado River, right?
Right.
Lower basin states are accusing the upper basin states of not taking conservation as seriously as they are.
That's right. And so that's playing out real time right now. And you look at how those Israeli solutions might work. I mean, certainly there are those applications in a variety of areas, including on the Colorado River.
Yeah. Let's take another break. We'll be back with Brian Steed, who's Great Salt Lake Commissioner. We're talking about the Great Salt Lake, obviously. More following this. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Brian Steed. He's Great Salt Lake Commissioner. He's also Great Salt Lake Strike Team Co-Chair and Executive Director of the USU Janet Quinney Lawson Institute of Land, Water, and Air. Talking about the Great Salt Lake here. You're looking at more than just the water. I say just the water. The water is of paramount importance, right?
Sure.
Keep that lake at a healthy level. But in the meantime, dust is a problem, kind of a growing problem. As the lake recedes, you have that dust. And this is not just any dust, right?
That's right. So it's interesting. I got into studying Great Salt Lake in part because, I just recently been hired here at Utah State to run the Institute for Land, Water, and Air. Great Salt Lake is the consummate example of how we use our land impacts how much water gets to the lake, how much water gets to the lake absolutely impacts air quality. And the relationship between air quality and the lake is as follows. As the lake gets lower, we have much more exposed lake bed. And as that lake bed remains exposed over a number of years, it begins to weather. And that means that we expect to have more dust storms come off of that. And in other places around the world where we have seen, the decline of these terminal lakes, and I'll cite one closest to home, Owens Valley, became a real problem because the city of LA diverted all the water from Owens Valley, and then the lake dried up. Owens Lake dried up. And they had, at one point, it was the largest source of particulate matter pollution, the largest source of dust pollution in the U.S. And you think about that, that's a lake 1/16 the size of Great Salt Lake. That could be very problematic. Now, they have more fine particulate matter there. They also have that it weathers differently. So I don't know that it would be exactly the same, but I will say that 16 times bigger it gives me a lot of pause. And when you look at how our air quality in the Intermountain, well, certainly in these confined basins, when we do trend into bad air quality, it tends to stay around for a while, and that's something that is concerning. The other thing, just as by way of the science of it, we don't know all the constituent matter of the dust. There's reason to believe as you test around the Great Salt Lake, there's arsenic and there's other heavy metals that are in the dust. We don't know how long that stays in. So in order to kind of understand that situation, we've been working very closely through the commissioner's office with the Department of Environmental Quality and particularly the Division of Air Quality to set up a more robust monitoring network around the lake. We actually took $1 million out of our allocated funds and distributed that to the Department of Environmental Quality so that we could set up this Utah Dust Monitoring Network. There's 19 monitors now being installed at some point around the lake. Those monitors will do two things. One, they'll tell us how frequently we're having those dust events come off the lake and the origin of the dust, because there's also a big dusty West Desert as well as places like Sevier Lake that also might be sources of dust. So one, it'll tell us that. Two, it'll tell us exactly what's in the dust. And I think both those facts are really important to know. And so I'm excited to see this getting up and running, because I think that in this case, this data will be really key to us understanding the risks as well as what the next steps are on the lake.
Of course, the best way to mitigate dust is to fill the lake.
That's right.
But absent that, how do you mitigate dust?
So when you look at what the city of Los Angeles did in the Owens Basin, they actually have done all sorts of different things, including they've taken gravel and put it in. There's an active sprinkling system they've put in on a lot of areas. There's other areas that they've just put these big berms in to try to capture some of the dust from going on. All of that's extraordinarily expensive. And so when you talk to the folks at Los Angeles, it's at least what they reported last year is $100 million per year in just maintenance costs on managing the dust out of the Owens Valley. And that's, consider this, in addition to the over $2+ billion that they've already put in that hardened infrastructure. Yes, it's possible to monitor the dust through other ways than just getting more water in the lake, but they're extraordinarily expensive solutions. And so I think that still from a cost-benefit analysis, the cheapest thing we can do is get more water to the lake.
Mm-hmm. Let's think about another couple of non-pure water issues. Salinity, you alluded to that earlier. Is that best controlled, only controlled by the manipulating the berm? Is that the...
So that's the adaptive management tool we have currently. Obviously, getting more water and keeping more water in the lake would be key to that. I don't know. The North Arm has been hypersaline since the 1960s. If the South Arm were to trend into that, it's a world of hurt for the ecosystem that we all rely on there. And I just, you know, if you go out to the Great Salt Lake during migratory bird season, it's kind of a religious experience. I mean, you see millions of migratory birds stopping through. And that's key to their migration patterns, I mean, all over the Western Hemisphere. I mean, some of these birds are migrating from as far south as Argentina and as far north as the Arctic. This becomes a crucial stopover point, especially considering that many of these terminal lakes are already dry or in such condition that they don't support life. So Great Salt Lake becomes incredibly important. And so I think that that's one. So we do monitor salinity very closely. The other thing we have on Great Salt Lake that keeps us really interested in the salinity is a very robust brine shrimp market. And this is something that most people don't know. But Great Salt Lake brine shrimp are a critical component of food supplies globally. Because when you look at Great Salt Lake brine shrimp cysts, the eggs, they float, and so they're easily gathered. Great Salt Lake brine shrimp cysts are used as food for a lot of farmed fish and farmed shrimp. In fact, there's about 50% of farmed fish or farmed shrimp globally are fed at some point Great Salt Lake brine shrimp. And think about that. If you lost that production, that would be a big impact on food availability as well.
So you've gotten a little bit into wetlands, the ecosystem for the birds. Tell me a little bit more about that. Is that just a matter of getting sufficient water to the lake, in this case toward the lake?
So we have been known around Great Salt Lake as a pretty special place for a long time. In fact, it was at one point the world's largest migratory bird refuge in the Bear River. Migratory bird refuge there on the kind of side there, the northeast side of the Great Salt Lake. So I think that we're world class. And when you look around the lake, some of those areas have been intentionally managed to make sure that they keep water and they keep water in areas that help provide habitat for ducks. It is critically important, and they are all interconnected. And so when I talk Great Salt Lake, I'm not just talking about the main body of Great Salt Lake. I'm talking about those associated wetlands as well, because that's all part of the web of life that's out there and really what we're fighting to save.
I want to talk specifically about the legislature. What, as a Great Salt Lake Commissioner, what kinds of legislation would you like to see?
So first and foremost, water transactions are complicated. And so this year we've been really focusing on how to make those water transactions less complicated. There's two bills that are making progress through the legislature right now. One is HB 348 by Representative Jill Coford, and this has a dedicated water provision to really make it easier for the state engineer's office to track when we say we're dedicating water to the lake, that we can facilitate actually moving that water through the administrative process as well as the physical process of moving that water into the lake. The second is HB 410, which is directly an ag water leasing program, and we've been working very closely with the ag community to make sure that we get this right. And to make sure that they can buy into it. And so in that case, we do have support, and I'm excited to see this move. It, again, starts an ag water leasing program that really helps facilitate those transactions and those transactions in a way that we get more wet water to the lake, which is really key. In addition to that, I think there's a whole smattering of other bills that we are tracking dealing with water use around homes. Again, conservation around our homes is part of what we're trying to do. And again, we use that water outside, and if we use that water outside, that's where the majority of our water that we're using in the municipal settings gets used, and we can do better. And so tracking how we do that, so we're tracking a bill by Representative Okerlund, HB 328, which is water use modifications, and this really does help incentivize better practices in new construction for water, wise landscaping. And then others around, there is a Representative Owens bill on water rates, HB 155, that we're tracking. There's one more that's not directly related to Great Salt Lake, but also really important to note is that we just have to know how much industry is consuming on water. And so Representative Jill Coford, again, has sponsored HB 76, which is an exciting bill that really tracks water usage on these large water users. I mean, initially she was focused on data centers. She's interested in those big municipal and industrial users of water and to make sure that we just have an accounting of how much water is being used there.
I want to talk about this. This interesting. You're seeing this. You're familiar with this, right, Brian Steed? It's hard on the radio to show you a picture, but in this strike team report, it's ecosystem of organizations working to restore the lake, and I was surprised by the scope here when I was looking at this. You got federal entities, academic institutions, the state, conservation organizations, and hybrid and other entities. So my question is, you're kind of overall, you're the commissioner. Is everybody working together? Are there tensions in that ecosystem, or could we improve in working together? Are we working together?
So part of the reason the commissioner's office was set up is to quarterback those various functions. And obviously, we have a lot more sway over the government agencies than we do over the non-government agencies. And I think that on the whole, I would say, Tom, that yes, we are working pretty well together. Is there room for improvement? Obviously, yes. One thing that was cool at the time that we had the signing of the Great Salt Lake Charter, we had two organizations come forward with a large commitment of private dollars. So we had both Ducks Unlimited come forward with $1 million pledge, as well as a new environmental organization called Great Salt Lake Rising that came forward with another $100 million pledge to say, we're going to bring private capital to this. And it's been fun because I get to work on both with those organizations as well as within the state. And I think that there is certainly, to answer your question, room for some improvement, but I'm actually pleasantly surprised by how well we all work together.
Hmm. We'll talk about research. Of course, you got your finger on the pulse there, the strike team and the Institute of Land, Water, and Air, right?
Yep.
Tell me about some highlights and research that are happening.
So, I mean, obviously this is... It's been an interesting journey because when we started this process, it was surprising how many gaps in data we had. And so the need for having good quality research is really key. One of the things that has been really meaningful through this process is working with top-notch researchers, both here at Utah State and at the University of Utah, to get the best data available. And I have to say that I'm so impressed by the work that's done at the Utah Water Lab, as well as on other divisions and departments here on campus, because we really couldn't do the job that we're doing without that. Important research, I think, that still has to be done is how we incentivize cities and towns to use less water. There is a new program out there. It's been going for some years now, but there's a new round of funding called Growing Water Smart. And then that'll be doing workshops throughout the area, focused especially in the central Utah Water Conservancy District and other places this year, because that's kind of on the south end of the Great Salt Lake watershed. And then just the research that's being done here to figure out how people have a relationship with water is key. One of the things I got to do last year is work with a graduate student who was working pretty extensively with farmers, right? And she came with this with a kind of an approach that she had never worked in ag. But it was really, really kind of fun to see, to say, oh, well, ag's not necessarily what I thought. It's not, and it was interesting to say, because she came up with ideas for how we could have agriculture be more at the table and be more winners, even while we're providing real solutions for Great Salt Lake.
Hmm. Anything else you'd like to say about Great Salt Lake or...
So I would just say that I think this is going to take a real team effort. And Tom, I so much appreciate you and your willingness to have me on today, because I do think that as we talk about the noise on Great Salt Lake, a lot of people, you know, get confused, or some people get downhearted to say, oh, well, all is lost. The reality is it couldn't be further from the truth. Yes, we have some challenges on Great Salt Lake, but our efforts actually do matter. Our individual efforts on how we treat water in our homes matters. And I think we're making real progress in ways that sometimes everyone doesn't see. And I'll also say, Tom, as a point of personal privilege, you know, you have been a household hero in the Steed household. My mom listens religiously, and she wanted me to tell you how much she appreciates the good work that you do in getting not only information out on Great Salt Lake, but on all of the other important public affairs issues you deal with.
Well, I appreciate that. And Mrs. Steed, thank you. Personal hi. Yeah. Hi to you. Appreciate that a lot. Brian Steed has been with us. He's Great Salt Lake Commissioner and Great Salt Lake Strike Team Co-Chair, also Executive Director of the USU Janet Quinney Lawson Institute of Land, Water, and Air. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thanks, everybody, for listening to Access Utah.